I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show.
Nine out of 10 doctors do recommend this podcast.
That's true.
So
excellent.
Yeah. It's good for your brain and also your mind.
I too am a fan of fun and real facts and statistics. That's great. As my mother always said, be incorrect but never indecisive.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So many.
So many.
So many damn books.
Well, we might as well start, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
We have Hannah Pittard with us in the damn library. I'm Christopher.
I'm Drew.
And this is So Many Damn Books, the podcast that is both a blessing and a curse.
Bringing that one back.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it is a good one.
And we are so glad to have you back for your new novel, Visible Empire.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be back here, but not back here. I'm in a new location. It's beautiful.
Indeed. Thank you.
The wall of books is lovely.
We have been a podcast for long enough now that people have written and published books since the last time that they came on.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's just super cool.
Yeah.
So we're really excited to be celebrating a release of a new Hannah Pittard novel.
Have other people pointed out to you that you now have it set up so that it's like an interrogation wall where the author is facing 100 plus books by authors who are better, more famous, more well-loved than they are?
I just did realize that I am currently blocking yours.
Oh, you have the Indispensable.
I do.
I don't even have the Indispensable.
Mm.
That's really pretty. It is. Look at that.
Well, you should definitely have your Indispensable.
I was going to say, I bet those folks at PALS will be like, yeah, here you go.
Before we get further, I mean, we just said that you've published other books, but those other books are called Reunion.
Yes.
Listen to Me. And
The Fates will find their way. I always want to say a way.
Find their way.
You should hear all the names that my family, so even it's book four and my family still doesn't take me seriously because I'm the youngest child. I'm going to be 95 years old and my brother and sister are still going to be making fun of me saying, now what did you do for a living? there are so many different names for The Fates Will Find Their Way. And for a long time when I was trying to get my second book published, they would say things like, why don't you just write The Fates Are Still Finding Their Way? Or The Fates Have Found Their Way Again? Or Did The Fates Find Their Way? And every once in a while I'll go to one of their houses and I'll find one of my that book and they'll have actually messed with the title on the cover and I'm like, how drunk did you get to do this work to my book? You must really love me.
Families keep you humble, right?
They sure do.
Can I tell you about the drink I made?
It's a good one.
It's delicious.
I'm calling it the Pink Chateau, which is a foreboding place in Visible Empire, but it's also a place of luxury. And this drink isn't actually pink. It's a light, sort of almost pink.
It's like apricot. It's apricot chateau.
Mm-hmm. But it's not pink. It's just luxurious, is what I was thinking. And it also has a large cast of characters.
Hey.
Like your
like
novel.
Like an ensemble novel.
Mm-hmm. And this is it has tequila, guava juice, fresh squeezed lemon juice, egg white, grapefruit bitters, and maple tea flavored simple syrup.
That's like perfect.
And I love messing with egg white. It makes for a nice foam on the top of the drink that when you finish the drink, it's like the last thing that you get is this nice, just airy, sort of marshmallow texture.
Oh, yeah, that is kind of what, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very proud of this drink. I think that anybody who would have it would enjoy it.
And there's a little protein in it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Egg white has some protein.
It's good for you.
It's good. Yeah. It counterbalances the alcohol. It's like you're. It's that like is negating. Science, yeah. It's science. It's science. Yes.
It's one of the reasons right. that doctors love this
we
show.
We know. Right. I think it's 9 out of 10.
Nine out of 10 doctors. So that's the drink. And I'd also now like to talk about what we bought.
Cool.
Because that's the next part.
That is the next part
of the show. Drew,
sure. I actually, speaking of Indispensable, I guess now it's the second latest. I haven't gotten my most recent yet, which is Tommy Orange's They're There, which I've already read and is amazing. But the last one that I got was Rachel Kushner's new book, The Mars Room.
Mm.
And they usually send cool things. They'll send the book comes in a slipcase and they'll throw in something. It's like chocolate or like a water bottle or a tote bag. Sometimes they throw in another book. This time they threw in two.
Wow.
Were they the books that were mentioned in the book that she reads in prison?
Oh, no, that would have been cool.
That would have been cool, right?
One of them was The Flamethrowers,
mm.
which is cool because I didn't have it. And I was like, oh, this is great. And the other is Ursula K. Le Guin's last like interview book that she did with this guy, David Namon. And it's interviews on fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. I think it's just called Conversations on Writing.
Mm.
But I opened it and I was like, three books?
Wow.
For
the price of, I don't know.
1.5 books.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
That's neat.
That's cool. Hannah?
The last books
that you bought?
So Mars Room.
Cool.
I just recently finished that. Terrific. Questions about the ending.
Mm.
Still thinking about it, but I absolutely loved it. Ensemble novel. Also, that I had not read any of the hype going in, so I had nothing to I had no expectations, and I was really surprised when I moved from the first person narration to the third of the teacher, and then when we got like the rest of the cast of characters, I was just totally blown away, and I loved it. Also recently bought and have read Exit West. I think I'm a little bit late to that party, but I really enjoyed it. And Less.
Sean Greer.
I just finished that, and I have just started having purchased it because I did not steal any of these, obviously. American Marriage. Terry Jones.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying that. I just finished the second chapter, and the first chapter was like, this is so lovely. They're so in love. What's the point of this book? It's so lovely. Bam, he's in jail. Oh, that's why. Okay. I love it. I'm hooked.
Nice.
I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, it's good.
Christopher?
I bought a book that I'm like crazy excited about. It's also one of these books that when you pick it up, it's bizarrely heavy, and it's because there's color photos printed in it. So that always makes the book like really hefty. So I bought Saving Central Park, A History and a Memoir by Elizabeth Barlow Rogers. And she's one of the main people who started the Central Park Conservancy.
Uh-huh.
And it's about like the time period of when Central Park was completely horrible and the efforts to save it.
Cool.
And so the pictures are of like what the park looked like before. And I don't know. I'm so excited to read this book. I've lived in New York for 6 years now, and Central Park remains my favorite place, even though it's a touristy thing. And there's a reason why everyone needs to go there all the time. It's fantastic. Yeah. And I should like Prospect Park more because it's closer and I go there more often. But Central Park still holds like some sort of mythological power for me.
It's pretty special.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that are
what we have bought.
Let's talk about your novel, Visible Empire, Hannah. It's such an achievement and a fantastic a historical novel in some ways.
Yeah.
Although it doesn't feel like one. Do you want to talk about what Visible Empire is about to our listeners who might not know?
So I'm from Atlanta. I was born there, raised there. In 1962, when I was not alive yet, in 1962 in Paris, a chartered Air France flight carrying more than 100 of Atlanta's wealthiest art patrons, all white, crashed on takeoff. And overnight, the city changed because obviously these were people who were at the top of the power of the infrastructure in Atlanta. And so this is a story that I grew up hearing about in the 80s and the 90s as a middle schooler, as a high schooler, because my parents had been alive when the plane crashed. My mom was 13, my dad was 20. And when they got together, by the time they got together, they knew many of the adult children who were left behind.
Oh, wow.
And so I grew up hearing stories, many of them, I'm sure, apocryphal, because I am a storyteller and I get my storytelling capabilities from my father, including hyperbole, exaggeration, and sometimes straight up lying. but I choose not to scratch that surface too intensely. I like the stories my dad tells me. I like the stories my mom tells me. But they blew my mind as a kid. And I was especially just taken by this idea of 100 plus people wiped out in one fell swoop in the 60s and in Atlanta. I always was really moved and interested as a writer in the idea of this kind of large scale tragedy happening not in LA or New York or mm-hmm. Chicago, where in general, I feel like the country tended to look towards disasters there, but it was in Atlanta where there was just so much change and upheaval and possibility for different outcomes back then. So it's just a story that's been in my mind for a really long time. And the book itself is not so much about the crash per se, but about the aftermath and about the way that the would-be and fictional survivors go about sort of picking up the pieces of their lives.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the story of the crash has been around in your mind for a long time. Has this novel been kicking around for a long time? Like, did you always know you were going to write this book?
Yeah.
Cool.
I did. Probably even before I wrote The Fates Will Find Their Way, this was the fantasy book in the back of my mind where I always thought this is the big book. I just need to be able to write this big book. And I could never, when I was working on The Fates Will Find Their Way, you know, this was just too big, too hard, too many people, too much research. I didn't know what research really meant or how to approach it. And then I was working on Reunion, and I was thinking about it a little bit more, and I was thinking, this is the kind of book. I was going through a real mercenary phase where I needed to make money. I was in a lot of debt. If anyone wants to know how much debt, you can buy Reunion. I'm out of debt, so you won't help me there, but you will help me by buying that book. but you can learn some pretty interesting facts about how far in debt I was. But I was just, my brain was working really quickly about like, how can I make money and what kind of book makes money? So I was not in a very artistic phase at that time of my life. So I had, by the time I'd finished Reunion and it was under contract, I had already started my third book, Listen to Me, and I was out at lunch with my editor, who's the same editor I have now. She's the editor for the last three books, and we were promoting Reunion. You know, she was carrying that around in her lovely, enormous purse where she would just produce a book. You know, we'd be sitting next to other book people at a sushi restaurant. I'm thinking of a very specific lunch. And she pulled out my book and showed it to these, like an agent editor duo sitting next to us. And I was like, how many other books does she have in that bag? Like, she surely really can't just carry mine around. She must be prepared to do this for all of her clients.
Mary Poppins library.
It's exactly like that. Like, hold on, let me dig around. And here's an extra outfit for when you pour red wine all over yourself. so she had reunion with me. I know that's what we were promoting. And we had just, I had just sold Listen to Me, and we were talking about the edits on that and where I should take that idea and take that book. So I'm still actively working on Listen to Me. And she said, so what else, you know, what else are you thinking about in the future? What else is, and I said, so there's this thing that happened in Atlanta, and it's the book that I've been thinking about for the last, you know, 10 or so years. And I described it to her, and she said, when can I have that? And I said, well, first, I'm going to finish Listen to Me, which you're really excited about. And she said, no, no, we're really excited about Listen to Me. When can I have that other book? And honestly, I'm making fun of this moment, but that was the moment where I knew that I was ready to write it, and I was excited to write it. And I knew that I also had somebody kind of in my corner wanting to read it. And I'm very good. You know, I've always been, I'm a classic achiever. If you guys know the Riso Hudson Enneagram I talk about this and Listen to Me. But I'm a classic achiever, and I really like to please, and I like to be the best of the best of the best. And so when I know that there's somebody who expects something from me, I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to let them down. And frankly, it was really useful knowing that my editor was excited about this book and she wanted it. So it made me excited to finish Listen to Me, which I did not skimp on. I really love every single word in that book. I think it's, like, in many ways my smartest book. But it made me excited to get through that book and then start this book. And I didn't, you know, was never ready until I finally told her about it, and her excitement got me ready for it.
And this is Helen Atzma.
Yeah.
At, I thought I'd at least give the name drop to her.
Nice. Yeah.
Hey, Helen.
And it's interesting that you had Listen to Me, like, sort of at the forefront while you were thinking about starting this, because they're so different books. Like, Listen to Me is, like, tight, just two characters, just 24 hours, basically. Visible Empire is a huge cast of characters. And there's, like, a Greek chorus even of the mayor and his wife who are just discussing and still working over their emotions.
It makes me so happy that you call it that. You know, I went to St. John's College, and it's very deliberately a Greek chorus.
Nice.
So thank you.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it came across.
Thanks.
And I don't know. I was noticing maybe just from looking at Listen to Me and then going to this one, thinking of forgiveness as something that you're working, that you often work with, especially with one of the main relationships in this book is Lily and Robert, who are having a tough time in their relationship.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know what, like, these seems like of course books are like a blueprint of your mind. So I'm just wondering, like, what were you working through with that?
When my third book came out, which is about a marriage gone, you know, awry, I just found out about my husband's infidelity with my best friend from grad school, and it kind of floored me. I was unable to make certain podcasts, and I came back in the summer. That's right, I totally remember that. But so I was working through that as I was starting this new book, which, even before he and I split up and before I knew why we were splitting up, I did know that I liked the idea of, as a project, as a challenge, the idea of beginning with a couple that breaks up, that's at the beginning of the novel, and how to reunite them at the end, having let them go on their separate ways for the entirety of the book, having let them do their own thing, experience their own losses, their own gains, so that when they come back together, they are completely different people, completely better people. They have a different kind of marriage and a different kind of relationship than they ever could have had before, but it took being apart in order to make them better being together. Mm-hmm. And that was just the idea that I had. And then my husband and I got a divorce, and I remember when I left New York, went home. He was in New York still. We didn't see each other. It was a lot of phone calls. I went back to Lexington. He finally came home about 3 weeks later, and we took the dog for a walk. I wouldn't let him in the house. I mean, we were crying, we were sobbing. We were best friends for so long. So it was very complicated, but we took the dog for a walk, and you know, there were tears, there was laughter, and at one point he said, you know, what's awful about this affair is that the whole time I just wanted to call you and tell you, like, I just wanted to tell you about how funny she is, and you know, she's not as awful as I always told you she was. And I remember stopping, and we were in this neighborhood where we always walked our dog with these beautiful houses. And I said, I want to tell you something right now. 2 days ago, I wrote a portion of this book, and it's not you. It's not what you're saying right now. I did not steal this from you. It has already been written, but I wrote a portion of this book where the husband is talking about how all he wanted to do while he was having this affair was talk to his wife, who he'd always thought of as his best friend. He just wanted to tell his wife, she's so funny about his mistress. Mm-hmm. You would like her. She said the damnedest thing today. Mm-hmm. And I told him this, and I was like, I just want you to know that was already in my book. And he was like, this is why you're fucking awful. And I was like, and I was like, you're the fuck. And then we started fighting. But it's true. I mean, this is why I am awful to be in a relationship, that I'm able to, while I'm supposed to be having this really traumatic moment, step back and be like, I just want to make sure you know, in 2 to 3 years, when this book that I'm working on finally comes out, this wasn't your idea. This was already mine. It's like, are you fucking real? And I'm like, are you? So I was working through some stuff, and one thing that I did, a real realization that I had, was I think that the world, the heart is a really complicated and big, capacious organ, and I think that we are all capable of loving a lot of people, and I don't think that love is a limited thing, and sometimes that the fact that we have such big hearts gets us into trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, and my ability to allow Lily, who is the pregnant woman who is left by her husband in Visible Empire, she's able to forgive Robert for leaving her because she experiences her own amount of, you know, sort of extramarital love, and she's like, I get it. You can love your husband and also love another man at the same time. And I think, I suspect, if there are any other egoists or narcissists out there, I think I'm both. But I suspect that many of us probably walk around and we're like, you know, I could have an affair and love two people, but I don't think the person I'm with could, because mm-hmm. like, he's really smart and lovely, but he's probably only able to love one person. But I know that in the past I've been like, I bet I'm good at it. I bet I'm really good at it. Like, I would, you know, I don't want to ever try it, having been through on the other side, but I'm kind of like, I bet I'd be really good at it.
I'd love to know, I mean, this is your fourth book, you're 4 books into your writing career. I'm just curious if you feel like your identity as a writer is like well represented by your work so far.
That's an interesting way of putting that question. I like it. Yeah, I'm really happy with the books I've written. You know, I feel differently about each of them. Before we came into this room, I was talking a little bit about Reunion as kind of my least favorite child. And it's funny because I have some colleagues who I work with and they love it. You know, they talk mm-hmm. about Reunion as just being this really open, honest, it's not trying to do anything. It's very, you know, straightforward. Mm-hmm. And I think of Listen to Me as a perfectly distilled version of a marriage on the brink. And I don't think there's a word out of place. And like I said earlier, I think it is kind of my smartest book, and I'm really proud of it. And I think of The Fates Will Find Their Way as this, I managed to get all 30 years of my life, the 30 years that it took me to sort of live and think about writing and think about reading, are all in that one book. It gets at everything that I was worried about and thinking about, sentimentality and nostalgia, the way that the men in my life, and I'm talking about, you know, my brother and my father, boyfriends, the men in my life seemed never to live in the present and only in the past. So I was really trying to deal with, and I think also we see often in TV and on in movies, men aren't sentimental and men, you know, don't wear their hearts on their sleeve. But what I see in real life is like men can be so much more sentimental and so much more emotional than women sometimes. And some of the most terse and tense moments of my life and uncomfortable and angry moments have been with women and really sharp moments, not with men. And so I was trying to talk about all of that, those 30 years of sort of working out men and women in The Fates Will Find Their Way. And I think I couldn't write it now. It's also emotional in a way that I don't think I could tap into again. And then there's this, you know, ensemble novel that has more perspectives than ever. And I wanted to write my big epic book, which turned out only to be 288 pages, which is like saying something for me because I usually come in at a like right under 200. And I think where I finally am is just ready to, I think my next book is going to probably be closer to reunion in tone and scope and ease. Mm-hmm. I just want to keep writing. I just want to, you know, write my next book. And
it's got to be a nice place to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is. And it certainly helps that I have a full-time job.
Right.
It helps that that full-time job is writing and teaching writing. And the university where I work is a research one, which means they emphasize and promote writing. And that's part of my job designation. My time designation is to write. And I'm very lucky and I'm aware of how lucky that is. But yeah, it's not a bad place to be on the eve of 40.
Mm.
So...
something else that I was looking at Invisible Empire was just your use of animals.
Mm-hmm.
There's some weird animals in this book.
Oh yeah, there are. The armadillo.
Yeah, there's the armadillo, and there's also the bird.
The bird.
Mm-hmm. A parrot?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah. And there was also like a dog was a big part of Listen to Me as well. Right?
Yeah.
Dog's a big part.
I'm just curious, like dog, I mean, all of these animals, they're like such an other, but they also like create like these big moments.
So I had a realization, and this happened yesterday, actually, about dogs. So I'm always telling my students, always kill the dog. It's kind of it's a joke, and especially my grad students, they read my stories and they don't tell me that they've read my stories, and then some, you know, they'll come to class and they'll be like, what do you have against dogs? Dogs die in my stories. And so I've sort of started this joke in class. I'll be like, always kill the dog. You put a dog in there, always kill the dog, because you're automatically gonna.
That's your Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, kind of. If there's a dog in my book, Ada Limon, who's a poet that I absolutely adore, and she happens to live in Lexington. I gave her Visible Empire, a galley, a couple months ago, and the first thing she tweeted at me was, "Is there a dog?" And I said, "No, there's not a dog." And she said, "There better not be a dog." And I said, "But there is an armadillo." but there's a book that is my favorite book from childhood, and it's A Dog of Flanders, and it is about Nello and Patrasche. And the book begins, Nello and Patrasche were alone in the world. They were friends in a friendship deeper than brotherhood. And Nello was, or no, and Patrasche was his dog. A dog of Flanders. And then it goes on and on. I listen to it as a book on tape, so sometimes I have to do it. Nello and Patrasche. That's actually how it sounded. Nello and Patrasche were alone in the world. They were friends in a friendship deeper than brotherhood. And Patrasche was his dog, a dog of Flanders. And then it goes on and on and on and on and on. But Patrasche dies. and I realized yesterday, I was talking to a former graduate student of mine who came to a reading last night, and I was telling her about this book, and I just stopped and I thought, this is why the dog always dies.
Uh-huh.
And then the reason in Visible Empire that a dog doesn't die is because my editor told me that it couldn't be another dog. She was like, you can't kill another dog. And I said, how about a man? And she said, no. There's too much death in this book already. And so then there had to be a hit and run. I knew there had to be a hit and run. That was always part of the plot. And finally I said, how about an armadillo? And she said, we can work with that.
Oh, wow.
That makes me think there are a lot of near misses in your work, actually, as I'm now like thinking back across all of your books. But I was so interested in when I started Visible Empire, because the story, like, the plane crashes and everybody on the plane dies, and it's not the way that we think about like big stories about tragedy, and the fact that there are people in this book who like could have been on the plane and weren't. And it struck me in a way that I think it rarely ever does when you read stories about tragedies, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, that all of these people are living through the grief, but also the sort of like, oh shit, that could have been me.
Right. Right. The survivor guilt.
Yeah.
Of it. Of just like, they weren't even near the plane, but just because someone they knew was on it, they have a weird survivor guilt about it.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, especially the Greek chorus chapters between the mayor and his wife, they're the only two real people?
Only the mayor is real. His wife, the Greek chorus chapters that we keep talking about are Ivan Allen, who is based on a real character. I've completely appropriated him as a politician, you know, in the same way that Philip Roth appropriates Lindbergh as president. Mm-hmm. I have just taken Ivan Allen, but Louise was the name of his real wife, and I made his wife Lulu, a kind of pet name of Louise, and I did that intentionally, a kind of nod towards reality, but not actually necessarily her. I mean, for all I know, somebody might have called her Lulu, but I don't know that to be true. What I wanted was to use a political couple as a way to anchor the book historically and also provide a method for me to be able to include some of those historical details, like Harry Belafonte. Mm-hmm. Right after the crash, Harry Belafonte is denied service at an all-white restaurant, and MLK cancels a sit-in that they were going to host or have in order to protest the treatment of Harry Belafonte in Atlanta. And they cancel the sit-in because out of respect for the people who have died in the crash. And I wanted to be able to bring in things like that without writing an essay. Mm-hmm. And when I first was working on those historical chapters, they all felt like essays. They felt like nonfiction. And when I put them as dialogue between the mayor and his wife, they became, to me, it felt like art. It felt like a way of hinting at these actual instances, but also using grief and looking at another relationship, the husband and the wife, a political relationship. So there, Ivan Allen is real. Lulu is imagined.
Interesting. Well, I guess this actually leads to a different question, but about the historical stuff that you're pulling into this novel. I feel like the other character who really, his chapters are sort of constantly referencing the sociopolitical climate is Piedmont.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher and I were talking about this earlier, and like the question really is just like, talk about writing Piedmont.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Piedmont Dobbs is a 19-year-old African-American. When I first started researching this book, one of the earliest works of nonfiction that I looked at was a book called The Explosion at Orly by Ann Abrams. And it's nonfiction, obviously. A small chapter in there deals with, you know, she's setting the tone of Atlanta at the time, but she talks about the Board of Education and what's happening with integration in Atlanta. And in 1961, Atlanta finally begins, you know, integrating, Brown versus Board of Education was passed in 54, and Atlanta took its very sweet time getting mm-hmm. around to, you know, actually doing what it needed to do. But one of the details in the book was that in 1961, there was a call, applications were accepted from African-Americans around town, juniors around town, to apply to be one of 10 Black students who would integrate 12th grade. And 132 people applied, 10 were chosen, and 9 ultimately enrolled. And when I read that detail, I thought, this is the perfect way into dealing with race, which I knew I had to deal with in part because it's 1962 and it's the South, and it would have been completely irresponsible not to talk about race and racial tensions, but also because of a Malcolm X quote that I discovered while I was researching this book. Malcolm X talks about the crash as the work of God. This is one of the epigraphs in the novel, but he talks about the crash as though it's the work of God, and he calls on God to do it again every day. And so the minute I saw that quote, I knew that I had to talk about race and I had to take on this subject. And then once I'd read the Book of Nonfiction and I'd seen this opportunity about 132 African-American students who had applied and only 10 had been chosen, I thought, what must it have been to be one of the students who didn't apply? And that is where Piedmont was born, from that idea. And from there, it just became, Piedmont's origin story chapter, I think that there are a few characters that have their origin stories, and it's like what this character is doing on the day of the crash. Mm-hmm. And Piedmont, when we meet Piedmont, he's been a year out of school. He drops out when he's not chosen to help integrate the public school system. He's working as a janitor. He's left his mother's home. His mother doesn't know where he is. And he's in this bar where he's mopping a floor, a white establishment, and he's watching these white men watch the television as their white friends die. And he's just standing there with his own personal, this huge devastation that he's had, not getting to integrate because he thought this was going to be his trajectory in life, to be a great African-American leader and lead his people forward. And so that hasn't happened. And he's standing there, 19, completely devastated. And his first thought is, the city had it coming. Mm-hmm. And he spends the rest of the book in some ways struggling through what it means to have had that thought as his first instinct, and whether or not he wants to be the kind of person who has that kind of thought as a first instinct. And I guess I understand that, you know, as a human being, not necessarily liking my instincts and trying to understand them and deal with them. So Piedmont was really close to my heart. And, you know, I understand there are certain risks with writing a character from another perspective. But I think at the end of the day, I choose to embrace the idea of radical empathy across racial boundaries, as opposed to, wanting to put boundaries between them.
Right, like staying in your lane.
Right. Yeah, I don't want, if I have to stay on my lane, I'm not going to write fiction. Mm-hmm. Right. If I have to write about what I know, I'm already bored. Like, I'm really already bored.
To pivot over towards the book that you brought, you pivoted in the novel to this book, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, as something that Piedmont had read. And was sort of saying, like, I sort of feel like this guy, but I also don't feel like him at all. The crazy thing was, I really felt like, it was funny, when I was reading Invisible Man, I was like, oh, this is probably where she got this. I don't know. Because I knew we were going to be talking to you about it. I kept thinking, like, oh, like this actually goes well with Invisible Empire. And like, oh, right. Because you told us to read it.
You know what's, I have, so in the interest of complete honesty, I read Invisible Man in college at the University of Chicago. I remember loving it. I remember being moved by it. And I did not pick it up again. And then I was working on this book, and I knew that Invisible Man was going to be the book that Piedmont's Piedmont has a teacher who is very moved by the book, and Piedmont even has this moment where he's talking about having been embarrassed by his teacher, you know, pounding the desk and being very emotional, which I think is something that, you know, all teenagers experience at some point. They're watching adults be emotional and you're like, oh my God, that's so awful. And then fast forward 10 or 20 years, as I have done from teenager to adult, and I think, you know, I am that adult. I have become the adult where I'm just like, youth is wasted on you. Have emotion. Like, don't be embarrassed. Have emotion. Like, embrace this. Do you understand this is about you? So that was very real for me. But it was actually after the book was finished. And my mom moved to Lexington, and my mom is just a voracious reader. She puts me to shame, colleagues to shame. She just reads so much. And she kept talking about Invisible Man. She was rereading Invisible Man. And I was so jealous and also mad that she was rereading it and how vivid it was, that I finally reread it in March or April. And I was like, oh my gosh, wow, this is really lucky how well this fits in. I mean, we have a dropout. I was so surprised, but then it's also a devastating book and so profoundly relevant still.
Mm. Wildly. Yes. I did not read it in school. My senior year of high school, my AP Lit class got split randomly. Mm-hmm. It was a class of 10 white suburban kids. We got split randomly between Invisible Man and Catch 22.
You got Catch 22.
I got Catch 22, which at the time I was like, this book is great, it's funny, whatever. And as I was reading this, I was like, fuck, I really wish I had read this in high school.
See, I had the opposite. I felt like I would have felt like Piedmont, and had my professor been, or my teacher been like, oh, like,
yeah,
yelling at me about how important this book was. I don't know. I feel like I would have been assigned an essay like, follow his suitcase. Right, like,
oh, absolutely.
Like, yeah. You would, right. And it would have just ruined it. Like, I love that I just got to actually listen to it. Joe Morton reads it, and it is.
I've listened to the Joe Morton. He is so good.
It's an experience. It's so, so good.
When the his name was Clifton portion. When I was listening to it, so I read obviously, but I also listen to books on tape when I run, and I started hyperventilating. When the his name was Clifton portion came on, I had to stop, like pull over my body. I had to pull over my body on a run. I was like 6 miles in, and it was difficult to breathe. I mean, I was wheezing on the side of the road.
Wow.
Listening to this, and I thought, this is insanely relevant. It is just so gorgeous and heartbreaking.
And his voice is great for it.
Yeah.
It's just, it has so much just depth and gravitas the whole time that you're just, I don't know, every voice that he does too. He does great voices for people.
He really does. Yeah. And the when he's describing Vespers at the college before the Invisible Man, the unnamed narrator, drops out, and he's talking about the bells ringing and the voices rising and the singing, it's just so gorgeous. I mean, it's a beautiful rendition of the book.
I mean, I love that this book goes into just how powerful a speech can be. And so, of course, I'm glad that I had Joe Morton speechifying at me.
Yeah.
Because, like, these speeches that he gives are unreal. And they also just seem like, I don't know, it's like just an ode to good speeches. Like, if you say the right thing, you can inspire people.
Yeah. So often when a writer said, like, here's this rousing speech and the people were so moved, you're like, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, every single time I was like, yes, okay.
Yeah.
What are we doing? Let's go.
Yeah, let's,
I feel the
put
same
these
way.
Furniture back in our house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think what makes it effective is that we are actually invited in the text of the book. We are invited to go on the journey with the character, that he does not go into it knowing that what he's going to say or knowing how he feels even. So we get to witness and move along with him from, you know, he's a cynic at times. He's doubting at times.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I don't really know what I'm saying at times. And then he starts, you know,
speaking. And it's just like when the Brotherhood brings him in for that, his first official speech.
Yeah.
And he's, it's so embarrassing at first, and he's mortified. And then the audience starts speaking to him, and he realizes how great he's doing, and he just gets so involved. And then he finds out that the Brotherhood hates it. Yeah. We experience that with him. We are, I mean, I'm nervous for him. I'm like, oh my gosh, the microphone is, mm-hmm. you know, speaking back to you. You're not the right distance from it. But then when the audience is involved, I'm excited for him. And then when the Brotherhood says you did poorly and he's so excited, I'm like, no, he didn't.
Yeah.
I'm as disappointed as he is. And it just, it does such a good job making sure that we're experiencing, I think, the revelations as he experiences them as well.
Well, mm-hmm. these speeches, they don't come from nowhere. It's not, he spent 90 pages of stuff happening to him that now he's going to digest in like these 3 pages of just beautiful, incredible prose. I don't know. That was another joy of this book, is like, it is devastating and so many horrible things happen and it's so violent. And just horror after horror occurs. But at the same time, there's just, Ellison just takes these moments to just give something nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like something nice will happen and you just, it'll lift you back up to like, let you, I guess, get you ready to get knocked down again by another atrocity. But just moments like when he pays back Mary for the rent that he just got hired by the Brotherhood, and he has this money and he's just trying to give her, and he like plays out that scene for a long
time.
Are
you not terrified the entire time that she's about to fall off the chair?
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing how tense we are during that scene that ultimately ends up being just this wonderful act of decency and kindness? The whole time I am expecting violence, accidental violence, you know, the work, quote unquote, the work of God, like a freak accident of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. He just turns around and walks out and she doesn't fall off the chair. But I'm so petrified throughout it, even in that moment of kindness.
I knew I wasn't going to be ready for this book when he finally reads the letter that he's been bringing around to people.
I knew that I was like, oh, just read the letter. Just do it. Just read it.
Because he's got the, so he's sort of kicked out of his college and he's heading around New York. He's been told by this guy, like, go see these people. They'll give you a job. You can make the money that you need to come back to school.
And he's given 6 letters.
Yeah.
And he's sealed.
And he says, you can't open these. And he's like, okay. And he's in bed in New York. And he's like, I could open these.
I've heard that people steam them open. I don't know how I'd do it, though.
I don't have any steam. Yeah. and then so when he's on his last letter when he finally gets it given back to him to read. And you're just like, oh yeah, that was somehow worse than anything I could have thought.
It's the beginning of his awakening that he doesn't want, right? I mean, it's like biting the apple, and this is the new
reality. His life
reality.
Is the unsealed letter.
Yeah, it is. Right. It's that moment where you can't go back again. Things have been irrevocably changed for him at that moment.
And yeah.
He can no longer just look at the world as a wide open future. He understands that there is adversity and like the rug is literally taken out from under him, and it's devastating.
Thank you for having us read this. This is one of those things where I'm like, man, I'm so glad I had the reason to finally pick this up.
Right.
I'm glad that you both read it as well.
Yeah. And it was so cool to read this and also have like that it was in conversation with something that it directly inspired, that was living inside you without you even realizing it. That's so interesting.
And I love having read it so recently. It's one of those books that I feel like we all need to read every year. It's that good and that powerful. Like, I just want to assign it to my students all the time now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we want to recommend other novels?
Sure.
Or other things? We can recommend anything.
Well, that's true. We can recommend anything.
Some pretty cool books. We recommend you take a look. Yeah.
Drew, do you want to start recommending things?
I will recommend a book that actually, when this episode comes out, I think it maybe comes out the week after this episode. But it is a book that I hope will hit the canon in the same way that Invisible Man does. It's a book that I want everybody to read and that everybody should read in school and reread. It's Amber Tamblyn's Any Man.
Mm.
The synopsis sounds like you're like, I don't know if this is going to work. The idea is that she's following a serial rapist who is a woman who is raping men. And she's following the men as survivors. And at first you're like, oh, I don't. And the thing that she pulls off, prose-wise, it's just like technicolor, dazzlingly beautiful. She's bringing in poetry and essay and journalism and fiction writing. And it's a really beautiful book on the sentence level. But it hit me in this way where all of a sudden I just like something clicked and opened and I understood the way that a victim moves through the world in a way that I don't think I ever could have, having been lucky enough in my life not to have been a victim of any kind of sexual violence.
Mm.
And I was like, man, this is what art is supposed to do. This is what fiction is supposed to do. It's supposed to provoke that radical empathy that moves you so far that you suddenly see the world in a different way. And it has been a long time since a book, especially one that I didn't expect. Like, it's a new book. It's not like it's a classic where they're like, your life will be changed. And then you're like, it was. This, I went in just being like, okay, I loved her poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it floored me.
Mm.
It's really good.
Wow. Oh,
that's a serious compliment. I can't wait to read it. I have not yet read it.
I have it on my shelf. I will pick it up sooner.
Yeah.
Do you want to go? Or do you want me to go?
Yeah, no. So I've been doing this thing lately where I'm trying to fill in some gaps too. But I've been going new, old
cool.
books. So two of the books that I had not read, but they're probably books that I claim to have read. but now that I've read them, I can say it's like having an eating disorder and getting over it, or being in debt and being out of it. You're like, you should know that back then. Now that I've read them, I can say it. American Pastoral, which is just one of the greatest novels that I can remember reading. And I can't believe I went so long not having read it. Philip Roth, it's absolutely gorgeous, heartbreaking. Another book that is still so relevant now. And he does such beautiful things with the narration and with the narrative. It's as fresh and as new as anything I am reading currently. And that's just a huge compliment. But also A Handmaid's Tale, which I had never read.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so that's what it's all about. So those were the two books that I've recently read that I should have read, you know, all of my life, and I didn't have them read. And I'm so glad that I now have them under my belt. But two things, both Atlanta-based. Atlanta, the show.
Yes!
Yeah.
It's so good.
So good.
I had been putting it off and putting it off. And if my 18-year-old niece ever listens to this, so she and I are so similarly... We have temperaments that, you know, we have to be right. And we're both achievers. And she said, you've got to see Atlanta. It's so great. And I said, yeah, everything I've read says it's just The Wire redone. I've already seen The Wire. And she said, oh, really? Everything you've read said it's The Wire? And I said, yeah, everything. And she said, just do me a favor and like watch one episode. And I was like, whatever. So I watched one episode. And then, of course, 2 days later, I'd seen the entire season, mm-hmm. because it is nothing like The Wire. And it's just so smart and funny and fresh. So that was just amazing. And then also Atlanta Monster, as far as podcasts go, I'm hitting up all of the senses.
Mm-hmm.
So you can read two novels, you can listen to Atlanta Monster, or you can watch Atlanta, and those are my recommendations.
Wow.
It was cool to start watching Atlanta while I was reading this book.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, oh.
And it's, I mean, unless I'm completely tricked, it's really filmed there.
Yeah.
it's good.
Yeah. I am going to recommend not a book, but it's based on a book. Netflix's adaptation of A Series of Unfortunate Events. Let me snick it.
Yeah.
Season 2 is so good, and it's even better than season 1 was. It's sillier and wackier. and I was watching it on a plane. And there's a part where it, for reasons, there's like a, they're like running around in a circle and there's a baby that's running with them, but they've switched the baby for a bag of flour. And, you know, Patrick Harris's character sees that the bag of flour baby has stopped running.
So funny.
And he's just like, I'm going to go kick that baby. I laughed so hard on the plane. Like I burst, and it's one of those like you weren't ever expecting to laugh that much. Uh-huh. That I just burst out laughing on this plane. And luckily it wasn't like an overnight flight or anything. It was in the middle of the afternoon. But people like came over and were like,
what you doing?
What you watching?
So that, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. So another book that I listened to and didn't read was the Rachel Kushner, the Mars Room. Mm-hmm. And she reads it herself, which is cool. Really interesting. It's her voice. But she tells one joke in it, and I was running, and I had a very similar experience where I started like snort, you know, as opposed to Invisible Man, where I'm so moved and sad that I have to like double over, nearly crying and hyperventilating. I was laughing so hard. And it's the one sex joke that this cop who's been arrested can remember. He has all of these jokes, but there's this one joke that he can remember, and he says the whole thing, and I just died laughing. And I couldn't wait to get home, and I told my mom the joke, and she had the same, she wasn't running. I was like, Mom, you got to hear this joke. And I told her the whole joke, and she just, same thing. It's just brilliant. I love when a book or a show just like actually gets you in stitches.
It actually gets you. Yeah. I love that too.
It's great.
So yeah.
I find that's happening to me a lot with two podcasts, The Adventure Zone and Hello from the Magic Tavern.
But both, those are meant to be funny.
But I feel like such an idiot when I'm like on the subway and I'm just listening, and I like have a smile on my face maybe, and something happens and I just start laughing, and I'm like,
ooh.
Sorry, nobody look at him. It's don't worry about it. Inevitably people, especially in New York, people are like, what are you laughing about?
Mm-hmm.
You must be a psychopath.
You must be insane.
Yeah. I can bring myself to giggles. I know we all need to stop talking, but I can bring myself to giggles walking down the street if I just think about the woman who plays the German character in Veep, who is constantly telling the vice president, we are best friends. No, you are my best friend. I just die. I'll just be walking down the street and I can hear her saying, no, because we are best friends and you know about penises.
Oh, man. Okay, I'm going to recommend one more thing now then. Another podcast to listen to. It's Meet My Friends, The Friends with Tom Sharpling. And it is sort of a Friends recap show, but
hell,
it is
yes.
Not actually that.
Oh man,
it's so funny. It's really about his assistants and how inept they are, and there are just some Andy Kaufman-esque things that happen that I just can't. And they also, all of the ads, if you're a podcast listener, it's making fun of every single podcast ad you've ever heard.
Great.
With two like fake mattress companies that are having fights in the in the ads.
That's awesome.
Oh my god, Meet My Friends, The Friends with Tom Sharpling.
Great.
Okay. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
There's a lot of good stuff out there.
One of them is Visible Empire by Hannah Pittard at your local bookstore now. Go and pick it up. It is a summer read. Actually, I would say
it's a good summer read.
It's luxurious, but it's devastating, and it's you know, a great novel.
Thanks, y'all. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for the drink.
No problem. And all of you out there in podcast land, we really appreciate when you give us money on our Patreon, patreon.com/smdb. You still have time to pledge at $10.
To get the tote.
And we'll give you a tote.
The cutoff will be very soon, though.
Yeah, super soon.
We might not tell you when the cutoff is.
Yeah.
So
jump on that and pledge us $10 and give us your money, because we like when we have it and we do cool things with it, like just give it back to you guys in tote form. And also go to iTunes and review us. We are so close to 100 reviews. Maybe by the time this comes out.
Really, really close.
Yeah. So go ahead and do all of those things.
And keep reading.
Keep reading books.
We did it.
Yeah,
goodbye.
It's over now.